What's up, everybody? Welcome to episode 2 of Radio Live Transmission. I am Ryan, your host. Thank you for listening. Radio Live Transmission is a bi-monthly podcast where I'll bring you music reviews for music lovers. On today's episode, I'm going to be giving you brief reviews of albums from The Shins, the band Spectres, and the band Pelorian. I will also be bringing you a slightly more in-depth review of an album called The Further Side by a band called Nova Collective. And in the main event portion of today's episode, a special guest and myself will be reviewing the classic Rush album, Permanent Waves, from 1980. So I'm excited. All right, so let's get to the reviews. Okay, so the first review is for the album Heartworms by The Shins. It was released on March 10th through Columbia Records. It was produced by James Mercer, who is the creative mastermind of The Shins and really the only constant member throughout the band's history. It's The Shins' fifth album. That's the first new material in 5 years. It received a Metacritic score of 73 out of 100, which is considered generally favorable on Metacritic scale. All right, so on Heartworms, James Mercer is mostly successful in integrating the sounds of 60s psychedelia and pop, in particular the sound of bands like the Zombies and the Beatles, with a more synthesized approach and bright vocal aesthetic, a sound modern while also belonging in a certain sense to the 80s. The best examples of Mercer's success on this album are tracks like Painting a Hole, with its insistent beat, slightly manic vocals, and George Harrison-esque flirtations with Eastern music. Another example of success is the track Mildenhall, with its reliance on pop simplicity. Another couple of good examples of successful use of a more simplistic sort of pop approach are the title track, Heartworms, and the closing track, The Fear. Lyrically, Mercer is able to pull off quite a few tongue-in-cheek turns in an almost Morrissey fashion, i.e. the line, "I always had something to hide, my skinny arms and my evil intentions." For the most part, the washes of psychedelia and electronica swirling around the sort of man with a guitar foundation coexist productively on this album. The only track that seems out of place is the track Cherry Hearts, which is synthesized to the point of feeling saccharine. It feels indulgent, and though it's not a bad song on its own, it's out of sync with the rest of the album for me. But all in all, Heartworms does a good job of melding the past and the present for a generation of listeners with a wealth of classic material to explore in this digital age of ours. I gave Heartworms a rating of 6 out of 10, and as far as suggested tracks from the album, check out the tracks Painting a Hole and the title track, Heartworms. Okay, on to the next review. Next album I'll be looking at today is an album called Condition by the Bristol, UK-based band Spectres. That's spelled S-P-E-C-T-R-E-S. There's quite a few bands called Spectres that you'll find out there on iTunes or any, you know, other music service that you look into, or, you know, even if you search for the band name online. So make sure you look for Spectres from Bristol in the UK. The album was released on March 10th through Sonic Cathedral Records. It was produced by the band and recorded by Dominic Mitchison. It's Spectre's second full-length album. It's the follow-up to 2015's album Dying, which is also a great album that you should check out. And Condition received a Metacritic score of 81 out of 100, which is considered universal acclaim. Now, I love challenging records. I like scratching my head after a first listen to an album and wondering how I'm going to make it through that record again. The most satisfying feeling throughout this process is the sense of reward that I feel once I've wrapped my head around a record and I've begun to appreciate it. Condition is an album that presented quite the challenge to me. I'm extremely selective when it comes to quote-unquote noise bands or artists. Typically, I enjoy noise more in the electronic slash industrial realm with artists like Nine Inch Nails and Ministry, KMFDM, bands along those lines. With the exception of a band like Sonic Youth, I can't bring to mind a band who deals in noise that I'm really motivated to listen to on a regular basis. I can now add Spectres to that short list. Condition makes a statement right from the get-go with the track The Beginning of an End, with its droning guitars, militant drumming, and vocals that are sometimes lost in the washes of noise. Then the track Rubber Plant kicks in with stabs of atonal guitar noise. This track is exemplary of the confidence and lack of flash that Spectres display throughout Condition, with the guitars attacking the listener out of nowhere, sometimes with just a single note, and then retreating again into the background. Rubber Plant also establishes a pattern that the record follows the rest of the way through, the tracks alternating between long explorations and shorter, more provocative and chaotic pieces. Spectres are a band who know how to bide their time and build tension. These sort of advance and retreat tactics are on full display on a track like A Fish Called Wanda. The songs on Condition would be brooding and menacing and uneasy even without the noise element, so the noise enhances these qualities throughout. For the most part, this approach works, but occasionally, as on the track Color Me Out, the noise element becomes a bit too distracting for me. Overall, though, Spectres have displayed an impressive talent for balancing chaos and order. I would much rather be challenged by a band than fed something easy to swallow and digest. I hope the Spectres can scratch this particular itch for a long time to come. I gave Condition a rating of 7 out of 10. And for suggested tracks, check out the tracks The Beginning of an End and Rubber Plant. All right, the next album I'm going to talk about today is the album Obsidian Arc by the band Pillorian. That's spelled Pillorian. It was released March 10th through Eisenwald Records, which is a German record label. And while I couldn't really find a Metacritic score online for this album, I looked up just a few reviews and scores to see what different online publications had thought of it. So Pitchfork gave the album a 6.8 out of 10. The publication It Gents gave the album an 8 out of 10. And Heavy Music Headquarters gave the album a 3 out of 5. So, since black / folk metal giants Agaloc disbanded last year, I've been a bit distraught pondering the future of its members. Fortunately, two bands have now risen from the ashes in the forms of Korada, which is spelled K-H-O-R-A-D-A, and that's a band that includes four of the previous members of Agaloc, including Don Anderson, J. William Walton, and Aesop Decker, along with the vocalist from the band Giant Squid. And the other band that has formed out of the ashes of Agaloc is Pillorian, which includes former Agaloc frontman John Haum, along with Stephen Parker of the band Maestas, and Trevor Matthews of the band Uada. I probably mangled those names, forgive me for that. Now, as a huge devotee of Agaloc, and somebody who can appreciate John Haum's solo work, which focuses on ambient and electronic noise, Pillorian doesn't compel me in the same manner that Agaloc did, at least not yet. I was excited but wary when I found out that Pillorian existed and that they would be putting out an album this year. I was quite surprised, actually, given the fact that we only found out about Agaloc's disbandment last year. So while Obsidian Arc isn't a bad album, it seems to be a record of movement or transition, and I'm very interested in what Pillorian will do next. But let's not get ahead of ourselves and judge Obsidian Arc on its own merit. If Agaloc had a current of folk metal running through their particular brand of black metal, then Pillorian is more piecemeal to me, in the sense that the folk specter of Agaloc sort of drifts in and out of the music. The opening track, By the Light of a Black Sun, kicks off with acoustic guitars reminiscent of something like the Agaloc album The Mantle, then shifts into driving black metal, and finally ends with another Agaloc-style acoustic passage. The next track, Archaean Divinity,
sheds the folk elements and shows you what Halm and company can do outside of the Shadow of Agaloc. But then the next track, The Vestige of Thorns, with its backdrop of acoustic strumming, again reminds me of Agaloc. In fact, this track could be a leftover from The Mantle. The next track, Forged Iron Crucible, is a great representation of the dynamic and unique sound Pelorian is capable of producing. Starting off with an almost Middle Eastern rhythm and instrumental aesthetic, before crashing into furious black metal and epic slabs of guitar riffage that sound like armies on the march. The song concludes with some of Halm's trademark ambient noise and leads to the track A Stygian Pyre, which is an unrelenting black metal piece that subsequently leads to a track called The Sentient Arcanum, which is the only track on the album that's dedicated to the quote-unquote ambient-slash-noise facet of Halm's artistic aesthetic. For me, the album could have actually benefited from more of these types of passages, and I hope that they include them more in the future. Since Agaloc, for the most part, consigned ambient noise elements to EPs such as The White and The Gray, more of this type of thing could definitely help Pelorian round out their sound and shake off the ghost of Agaloc, if that's possible. The closing track, called Dark is the River of Man, also displays potential for a unique sound, with vocals that sound elegiac at times and chant-like at others, and plodding guitars that rise to a satisfying climax in the last few minutes of the track. It's tracks like this one, balanced against the chaotic black metal and interesting atmospherics, that sound like the future of Pelorian, and I hope that they keep moving in that direction. I gave Obsidian Arc a rating of 6.5 out of 10, and for suggested tracks, you should check out the tracks Forged Iron Crucible and the track Dark is the River of Man. Okay, I'm going to do one more review before we get to the main event section of today's episode, and this review is for the album The Further Side by the band Nova Collective. It was released March 10th through Metal Blade Records, and it was recorded by Jamie King, who was a longtime producer for the band Between the Buried and Me. Nova Collective is comprised of Dan Briggs of Between the Buried and Me and Trioscapes, Matt Lynch of Trioscapes and also the band Cynic on drums, Richard Henschel of English prog rock band Haken on guitars, and ex-Haken member Pete Jones on keyboards. Nova Collective's story is an interesting one. About a year and a half before the release of the record, Dan Briggs and Richard Henschel were in constant contact, emailing each other about musical ideas. This led to demo material being written and recorded, which was exchanged. Briggs and Matt Lynch wrote and fleshed out ideas here in the States, while Henschel and Pete Jones did the same thing across the pond in England. The Transatlantic Collective convened in early 2015 to begin recording, and The Further Side is the fruit of their labors. So Nova Collective, sort of as a prog slash jazz slash fusion band, don't really break any new ground on The Further Side, so much as show just how interesting and accessible these elements of music can be. The songs on this album, even the ones that pass the 7-minute mark, all are grounded by very clear musical ideas that the band, though fully willing to do some noodling, never stray far from. Their playing ability is top-notch, and their songs sound like love letters written to jazz fusion and prog rock. The song titles on The Further Side perfectly encapsulate the music contained within. Opener, Dancing Machines, sounds like an artificial intelligence program to jam on jazz fusion. The next track, Cascades, is full of beautiful waves of shimmering guitar, and it tips its hat to prog legend Rush while refraining from imitation. The next track, called Air, operates like the oral equivalent of a rising wind that pushes a listener along passages tinged with funk and Eastern mysticism, then becoming a whirlwind as the guitars and keyboards race each other through frenetic passages and finally settle back down. The sci-fi jazz freakout State of Flux presents the image of someone ramping up the dancing machines of the opening track and showcases the musical abilities of each member in an interesting, if not necessarily subtle, fashion. Around the 6-minute mark, the whole machine seems to shift into overdrive, and alternates between coming close to imploding and evening out into beautiful passages. On the next track, ripped apart and reassembled, the machines settle into a spacey, funky groove as the band members again take turns, taking a listener on a journey through the labyrinthine halls of jazz fusion. The closing track, The Further Side, is the climactic, epic journey you expect, with plenty of changes in both tempo and mood. Eventually, everything except the piano falls away, and the keys are left to fill the void before the final fireworks display, which is refreshingly subtle on an album with its fair share of prog noodling. Nova Collective seem to love the exploration of fusion and prog this album allows them, and they're far less concerned with being flashy for flash's sake. Very few times while listening to this album did I feel bogged down by the band's technical forays. They're good enough songwriters to avoid those pitfalls, and I think they could only get better with time. So I gave The Further Side a rating of 7 out of 10. And for suggested tracks, check out the tracks Dancing Machines and the track Air. Alrighty, without any further ado, let's get to the main event. Welcome to the main event section of this episode of Radio Live Transmission. We're going to talk about Rush's album, classic album, Permanent Waves. The guest that I have today, his name is Mark Fossarilli. He's a member of the progressive rock group Mile Marker Zero. Why don't you say hi, Mark?
Hey, Ryan, how's it going?
Good, good. How are you, sir?
I'm doing good.
Good, good. Thanks. I'm excited to talk about Rush today.
Me too. I'm always excited to talk about Rush.
Exactly, yeah. So. Yeah. Why don't we get right into it? Why don't you give the listeners just some info, you know, about your relationship with music, just some background about you as a musician and about, you know, Mile Marker Zero and pretty much anything you'd like to tell the listeners. So.
Cool. Yeah. Well, as far as for me with music, I started taking piano lessons when I was about 8 years old in second grade, and you know, did the usual piano lesson thing, and then in middle school the bug of to really play hit me. I wanted started playing like in school and you know other places around, and then as I got into high school I took more lessons. I took jazz lessons, classical lessons, and started playing in groups, and obviously, and then went to major on it, went on to major in it in college, and then obviously as a professional. When I was really, really young, I was, you know, probably just into whatever pop music was big at the time. And probably the first big thing for me was my cousin at the time was showed me Van Halen. And Van Halen was probably the band that bit me and really made me want to they were the first band that I got obsessed with. And then my dad, knowing that I was taking piano lessons, showed me Emerson, Lake and Palmer, and Keith Emerson became my idol. And so the combination of those two really sparked my musical interest to do what I do today, you know, using the background that I have. But, you know, I've never been able to shake the rock bug like hits you, it's very hard to get rid of that. Especially when you're around a lot of other musicians who don't play that music, because I have to play a lot of non-rock music. You get a lot of guys, well, you know, I grew out of that, but so I kind of sort of assumed that I would grow out of it, and like the exact opposite happened. But I obviously still have a great affinity for all the other kinds of music. Mile Marker Zero, the beginnings of it were back when I was in high school, when I met Dave Alley, my singer, and a friend of mine, Tim Rakowski, who was our bass player. And we played gigs. We played a lot of Ben Folds 5 covers and classic rock and stuff. And then as we moved on and we went into college, the band really shaped to what it is now. We met our guitar player, John Tuohy, and Dave's brother, Doug, took over drums. So Mile Marker Zero has been going for about 11 or 12 years now. We have two EPs and a full length. And like you said before, we're a progressive rock group. We are more song in the song based. We, you know, like you mentioned, we're going to talk about Rush. They're a big influence on us. Mm-hmm. And you know, a lot of, so the, you have the classic bands like Rush, Pink Floyd, Genesis, but also we were really into, you know, the combining it with some of the 90s bands, you know, Perfect Circle and Tool. Mm-hmm. And in that kind of realm. So what we're doing right now, after we supported Young Rust, we were honored to win the 2016 New England Music Award for Best in State for Connecticut.
Congratulations on that.
Thank you very much. So sure. We did that. We've been playing a lot of the music, some of the music festivals on the East Coast. We just did Millennium Music Conference in Harrisburg, mm-hmm. Pennsylvania. And we did Dewey Beach Music Conference in Dewey Beach this past fall. Mm-hmm. But for about a year and a half now, we've been working on a new album that we hope to put out hopefully in the summer. Mm-hmm. We're tackling a project that we've always wanted to do, which of course, if you're in a progressive rock band, you got to do a concept album. We've always wanted to do that. And so we decided that now is the time and we're diving into that, which is quite an undertaking. You got to come up with a narrative and you got to you got to find music themes that connect with it and, you know, all that stuff. Right. So that's where we're at right now. And mm-hmm. we're recording. We got about half of it recorded right now. And we put up some pictures and videos online. Our Facebook is MileMarkerZero. We're on Twitter and Snapchat. I believe it's MMZ Official and Instagram as well. You know, all the good social media stuff, as well as our website, MileMarkerZero.com. Kind of putting out little feelers as to what we're doing and kind of bring the fans in to see, you know, what we have going on and how the process mm-hmm. is coming together.
Awesome. Well, I'm glad you did. I'm glad you plugged all the social media, because I was afraid I was going to forget it after.
That's okay.
All right. Well, that's great. I'm really excited, for the concept album that is to come. So I've always been a fan of concept albums too. And you were talking about how the amount of work that goes into it conceptually and, you know, just with a narrative and in some cases almost a certain amount of world building, if you will. Mm-hmm. That's something that, has always intrigued me. So I have a lot of respect for any band, you know, in any genre that can do that. So, so that's really cool. So I'm excited to hear that.
Thank you. We're sure. Extremely excited. Definitely the biggest project we've ever undertaken, the most, you know, dynamic and mm-hmm. just overall, you know, overwhelming, but it's been a lot of work. It's a big process, but mm-hmm. we're beyond excited the way it's come out. And I think it's going to be really exciting. I think people are really going to enjoy it. Mm-hmm.
Not to put you on the spot, but if you had to pick, let's say if you had to pick a favorite concept album, I know it's tough. But just, you know, something that pops into your head, like a favorite concept album, what do you think you would come up with?
That actually is really easy for me.
Well, that's good.
Dream Theater Scenes from a Memory mm-hmm. was a very important album for me. It came out when I was at the end of high school. Mm-hmm. And nobody was doing music like that at the time.
Right.
So being a keyboardist in the 90s was a very confusing time. You know, it was like keyboards were not cool at all. And, right. All the music that I loved, you know, the older music that my dad had gotten me into was all being made fun of. And, mm-hmm. you know, so that kind of, that it grabbed me. And it was, mm-hmm. you know, some of the older music, the Genesis and the Rush and stuff that I've been listening to, but it was modern. Mm-hmm. It was heavy. It was, I had never heard musicians play like that. You know, they were like mm-hmm. the Guitar Hero band before that. You know, they kind of set the stage for all that kind of music. And so that album is still my favorite album to this day, and that mm-hmm. that's been an album that we've referenced many times. But I also loved The Wall, Dark Side mm-hmm. of the Moon, OK Computer, more recently Porcupine Tree's Fear of a Blank Planet, and the most recent Between the Buried and Me. I really that's probably my favorite thing. Yeah. Coma Ecliptic. I there haven't been a ton of albums that I've really really been into, but that one mm-hmm. really grabbed me. Yeah, I love the Queen influence. I'm a big Queen fan, so I really like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was a little, as a big Between the Buried and Me fan, I remember I wasn't quite sure. I remember when I heard like the first track that came out off of it, I was like, I don't know. But I mean, they've never, you know, they've never really disappointed me. So,
right.
So I knew that once I gave it a few listens and sort of absorbed it, I, you know, it would definitely become one of my favorites, and it did. So
yeah.
So yeah, so that was a great album. I'm excited to see what they do next too.
Me too. I don't know how they're gonna top that. So we'll have to. Yeah.
All right. Well, why don't we talk about some Rush then?
Sure.
All right. So today we're talking about Rush's 1980 album Permanent Waves. It was released on January 14th, 1980. It was produced by the band and Terry Brown, who had already worked with the band numerous times on albums like Fly By Night and pretty much I think everything they did, right, Mark? I mean,
yeah, they did. He did every album of theirs up until Signals, I think.
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
And Terry Brown is actually the narrator on Scenes from Memory. Funny you should say that. Anyway.
It's awesome. I feel like it's like pop-up video, but the Skype version.
Yeah, basically.
it was Rush's seventh studio album, and it was their first album to crack the top five in on the U.S. Billboard 200 chart. It got up to number four. So that's all the basic info. And Mark, if you'd like to sort of give your overall impression of the record, and you could talk about how it's influencing your work with the band now.
Yeah, when you would talk to me about, an album that we could talk about, I chose Permanent Waves because, first of all, it has become, I think, my favorite Rush album. I go back and forth between that and Hemispheres. Mm-hmm. Permanent Waves was a real kind of watershed moment for them. It's definitely brighter than some of the work they've done. If anybody's ever seen the Beyond the Light of Stage documentary, Rush talks about how Hemispheres, like almost killed them. It just was such an undertaking. It was so dark. It was so heavy. It was so big that they were like, we just can't do this anymore. So you definitely can hear there's like a revived energy in them. But just sonically, that was the sound we were going for as far as just the tone of the instruments in the band for our newest album. So the producer we're working with suggested that. Mm-hmm. And it made me kind of – I obviously heard it so many times, but I went back and listened to it again in a different way. And this kind of being a sort of watershed moment for us, it makes sense, that that we would want that kind of sound, not only the way the guitars and the drums sound, but the keyboard sounds of the time. And Permanent Waves is just – I think for Rush was where they were able to – obviously, I'm still the biggest fan of their 70s work, but they were able to take that songwriting and that approach and combine it with newer, they were really into new wave and that kind of stuff at the time. And they did kind of, even though we're not in our work bringing it into a smaller realm, they were able to kind of do it in a more packaged, a smaller package than some of the stuff on Hemispheres, and they definitely opened the door for where they were going to go.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things that's always struck me about Rush in general, and certainly on Permanent Waves is how they can manage to, show so much professionalism and musicianship, and ability, but at the same time, they know how to package that all into something that's very catchy. It's very accessible, even in the longer tracks. I mean, it really is amazing. What I like about Permanent Waves is it's interesting because I feel like the way the album is kind of like broken down. It's interesting. It's almost like, it's two parts of a whole. Like it follows like a sort of similar pattern with the first three tracks. The first two leading up to Jacob's Ladder being a sort of longer, more like brooding sort of epic song. And then when you get to Entre Nous and you get to Different Strings leading into Natural Science, it's almost like, I don't want to say like the record resets itself, but it's, to me, it's an interesting sort of format for the record. And, I think the spirit of Radio, the track itself is like, I think that captures that essence of what I was saying about how they can be, at the same time, be so accessible and, amazing players at the same time.
Absolutely. The Spirit of Radio is, it's weird. Like I've heard that song, it's one of like the three or five Rush songs that classic rock always plays. But for whatever reason, that one, I don't get tired of, as much as I love Tom Sawyer, like I probably don't need to hear that again,
Right.
But,
right.
But Spirit of Radio, there's just this earnest quality mm-hmm. to it. I think the lyrics have, there's some of his best lyrics are on Permanent Waves, and I'm mm-hmm. it's weird, I'm not a big lyric person, but Neil Peart's lyrics have always kind of touched me. Mm-hmm. It's in the way that they're able to write music that connect people. Neil is able to write lyrics that sometimes are really, really deep, but they still connect with people. They're not over your head if you really, you know mm-hmm. what I mean? Like it's a very hard, you know, bridge that they cross to write mm-hmm. stuff that's is heady, but also can still connect with people. They're able, and Getty's able to sing those lyrics in mm-hmm. a way that doesn't sound like it's so over your head, which is really, really difficult.
Right, right. When I was listening to the album, there's a feature on, I think it's Amazon Music I was listening to it on, and where the lyrics like actually come up as you're listening to the song now.
Oh,
and,
nice.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And I was thinking the same thing. I'm like, man, I'm like, these, the lyrics, they're like deceptively like complex, but like you're saying, at the same time, they're very relatable. They're not hard for you to understand. It's just that, you know, you can tell that they're very thoughtful lyrics.
Right. I think people used to criticize, you know, try to, you know, people who pass Rush off, you know, and, mm-hmm. you know, at the snooty journalist, you know, it's like they try to act like, you know, oh, well, you know, Rush is just too heady. And I always find that ironic. It's like, oh, I'm sorry. Was it too smart for you? Like, it's, right, it's really right. not. Is it like because you couldn't understand it because you didn't take 5 seconds to read it? Like, it's, right. you know, it's I mean, yeah, it is deep, but. Mm-hmm. It's if you read it, it all makes sense and it connects. And, you know, especially Spirit of Radio is just the way that they paint, you know, art versus commercialism, and it's done. I don't know. I just think it's so brilliant the way he did it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And another thing, too, that sort of runs throughout the album, but is very much apparent on Spirit of Radio for me, is how not only it's like they're able to write music that like connects in a similar way to the lyrics. Like it's almost a similar theme. Like the lyrics of The Spirit of Radio sort of give you that impression of, you know, like he says, the unobtrusive companion, mm-hmm. You know, that's somebody that is like comforted and excited by that radio that's in the background. It's like, it's almost like an old friend. And then the music itself in the same vein is, it's very familiar, and it's very the only word I can think of is accessible. Even though mm-hmm. even though at the same time there's, you know, there's some pretty technical stuff going on, you know, with the guitars, and, you know, there's a lot of like there's those drum fills in the beginning and stuff that mm-hmm. you know, it goes on in the background. So I mean, somebody who's not really has their ear to that, like somebody who's not a musician or somebody who, you know, just sort of appreciates music for the entertainment value versus the technical side of it, might not right. really notice that stuff. It's just a catchy pop song, you know.
But, right.
But
Spirit of Radio is really optimistic, you know, like mm-hmm. the way that you know how the thinking of the radio and the music as your friend, and he kind of hits on the same thing in Natural Science at the end. It's almost like it bookends the mm-hmm. way that, you know, this can art can still be a true form, and we can still express ourselves irregardless of what, you know, is the way business and the way that society is treating it. And, you know, you almost could relate it to the way that music and is treated now, you know, it's a different time, but, you know, yeah. us as musicians, sometimes you do feel like you put work into things, and, you know, it doesn't, you know, it goes by people so quickly,
right.
you know, but you do it because you love it. And the people that you do connect with, you share that connection with you. And that's something that no matter what happens, you can't replace that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I also like one of the moving on to. Is there anything else about Spirit of Radio you wanted to say? I don't want to cut you off.
No, I think, I don't know. There's like I said, there is just something about. It's just so wrapped up nicely. Yeah, even there's the intro that's, you know, you could almost start the song where the main groove comes in, but mm-hmm. The melody is fantastic. The riff, the feel, I don't know, and they do so many different things. The reggae part.
Yeah, I was just really, gonna say that. Yeah,
it really is a brilliant song.
And with Free Will too, going along with that idea that I was talking about the music and the lyrics sort of interconnecting. I one of the things I love about Free Will is how you know, it moves up to a certain point. It moves along just like, you know, just like a pop rock song, like The Spirit of Radio, and then there's the part in the middle where all of a sudden, you know, it's the Geddy Lee's bass line is isolated for a minute, and it almost sounds for a second like it's going to be a solo.
Right.
And but then I just love how that bass line and licensed guitar solo in there sort of, it's like they're working together at the same time. It almost feels like they're battling or doing their own thing. And I just think that's great. I think that, you know, the fact that they were able to like bust that out right in the middle of the song is a good sort of, it's a good sort of metaphor, I think, for free will.
I think it's
pretty cool. Like, I don't think those things, you know, some people might think that, like, those things are sort of accidental or whatever, or just coincidence, but I certainly don't think so. I think, you know, all that stuff is, you know, Rush is intelligent enough and clever enough to do all those things intentionally and pull them off.
Yeah, they're a very, you know, individualistic in the sense that they really, you know, you go back earlier in their career, like, you know, 2112 is, even though it's about, it's based off, you know, a novel and it's about a dystopian society, it was really like their backs were against the wall to the record company, and they, you know, it was like, no, we're not going to do what you say. This is what we, you know, this is what we're doing, and we'd rather go down doing this than succeeding with what you want. So yeah, you're right. I guess that would make sense that, you know, that they are individualistic like that. You know, and they, you know, they kind of spread their power trio wings, you know, where like everybody has to take up a lot of space, but it works together, even though it is busy. Right.
It's funny, 'cause then, you know, you go from those two tracks, which are very, you know, very catchy, very accessible, you know, not, you know, proggy and too much. I mean, like we mentioned, it's kind of they're proggy and sort of brief moments are like in the background, you know, and then, you know, you get to Jacob's Ladder, which personally, like after the first two tracks, I feel like Jacob's Ladder is, Up until the part in the middle where the synthesizer comes in, to me it's like a little boring.
Okay.
But then right before the end, where, you know, there's when the drums really come in, those like thunderous drums, and there's a line about, you know, men looking to the sky, and you sort of get that image of the sunlight finally breaking through the clouds, you know.
Right.
That's the point, like where the song really affects me, and I'm like, oh man, it's right at the end. But yeah, like I said, the first half is a little drags like a little bit to me, but then really the second half, like I said, when the synthesizer comes in, I'm definitely more into that part of the song.
It's funny because like the ending line of the song was my high school senior quote. You know, because I had to be that guy, I guess. Well, that's what I am. But I was just talking about this with Dave the other day. I think he kind of feels the same way. That's not his favorite song on this album. I actually really, really like the first half. It's funny you say that. Mm-hmm. I really like the guitar melody once it goes in the groove. It isn't it's a strange thing. It's like through composed where there's no chorus. Mm-hmm. It's just kind of like, here's a part, then we go to the next part, then we go to the next part. But I understand what you're saying. I guess because I really like that. I really like the main guitar melody and then the chords it goes through. But I absolutely agree with you. The imagery of like the sky opening up at the end to bring the song to a close.
Yeah, for me that part, it sort of it definitely makes up for any boredom I might feel during the first part of the song.
Sure.
sort of like a, you know, a film with a that was iffy up until, you know, the last half an hour or so, how, you know, that ending might make up for you know, whatever negative, you know, things you might have thought about it. But so yeah, and then like I mentioned earlier, I feel like after Jacob's Ladder, then they sort of move, you know, they move back into that mode of being more accessible. With Entre Nous. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly.
No, that's right. Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah, and which, you know, of course means between us. And I like that, you know, it's at this point on the record where, you know, they introduce more acoustic elements into it. And it's funny because after I had listened to it again, after not having listened to the album for a long time, I was like, oh wait, I was like, was there anything really before this, you know, in the first few tracks, you know, like acoustic? And I'm like, I don't think so. I think this is like where,
yeah, I think
where
you're right,
where they come in. So I think that's kind of cool. It like I said, it sort of makes like the two, so like if you were listening to it on vinyl, I'm sure, you know, it's side A and side B. It makes side B, you know, a little bit stand out a little bit from side A. So I think that's pretty cool. I don't think there's, besides the acoustic elements, I mean, I don't think there's anything that makes Entre Nous like stand out too much from something like, you know, Spirit of Radio or Free Will, but I definitely like the way that, like I said, they move into that slightly different instrumentation, you know.
Right. Entre Nous for a long time didn't really do that much for me. Like when I first heard the album, I was like, oh, that sounds okay. You know, that was kind of like my least favorite of them. And I would probably say just by default, it's probably my least favorite. But actually, what made me rethink it was, I was mentioning the documentary, the Beyond the Light stage movie. Billy Corgan in that movie talks about how much he loved that song, and he used it as a way to try to connect with his parents, which I guess when he was a teenager, he was having a hard time connecting with them. And so it made me go back and re-listen to it. And the way they kind of orchestrate, you know, they get quieter in the chorus, which is cool, which doesn't happen very often, you know, underneath the lyrics about, you know, speaking about the relationship between two people, that kind of like sensitive, more vulnerable feeling. And I heard that, I didn't understand that when I was younger. So that made me look at the song a little bit different.
Yeah, it's amazing how sometimes, you know, because since music is such a personal thing, you know, you get so used to, you know, your personal interpretation of a song, and then sometimes you'll hear a story, like you said, you know, that will just completely like throw you for a loop. And I think that's one of the very interesting things about music in general, is just the myriad, you know, interpretations that people can have, and how that can, you know, especially like with concept albums. I mean, you take a band like Coheed and Cambria, and you know, as Claudio's, you know, said so many times, the overarching storyline of, you know, that runs through the albums, and you know, there's obviously like comics and everything that go with it. You know, he's always said it's like a sci-fi storyline that he sort of came up with to sort of like mask, you know, the actual story of his adolescence, because he was always kind of afraid to, you know, to just like hold that story up to the light, you know, for people to see. And so I think it's very, I've always had that sort of interesting relationship with Coheed's music, in that I can listen to one of their albums, and if I know the actual storyline that goes along with the comics and stuff, then I can have those images in my head, and it's sort of like an epic sci-fi movie or something. But then, you know, I can also, you know, go back to what Claudio himself was going through at the time when he wrote the songs, and you know, it becomes like a much different sort of movie, if you will, that you know, that I have in my head, you know, that's just much more, you know, about an internal struggle. And so I that's one of the things that I've always found interesting about interpretation of lyrics and music in general. And so I think that
if you don't mind me putting in real quick, Coheed recorded a lot of their albums, not all of them, but a lot of them, up at Applehead in Woodstock, New York. And we did a good chunk of the self-titled album and our Young Rust, or some of the Young Rust tracks up there. And we were up there right after they did, Good Apollo 4. Cool. I was like, oh man, Welcome Home was recorded in this room, you know, like they actually showed us some of the not the most recent one they did, the one that was the two separate ones, Ascension.
Oh yeah, the Aftermen.
They showed us some of that, like they had just finished, they were like in kind of demo form. It was cool to hear that, and you know, they talk about what they worked on, and incidentally Dave does an incredible Claudio Sanchez impression. I don't know how to but he did it for the producers, and they were like, oh my god, it sounds just like it. So you have to hear it sometime. It's pretty funny.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'd love to. And I mean, then moving on to Different Strings, I feel the same way about this song, the same way I feel about like, if you look at, you know, we were talking about Between the Buried and Me earlier, on the Colors album. If you look at the track that comes right before the end, right before White Walls, I think it's called Viridian. Obviously, that track is instrumental, but I kind of feel the same way about Viridian leading into White Walls, the way that I do about Different Strings leading into Natural Science. It's sort of like the moment when you know, they sort of pull everything back, and there's a, you know, there's kind of like a, there's a build up, there's a suspense, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really, you know, the most, that's the biggest impression that I get from it. I mean, it doesn't strike me as much as, you know, something like Spirit of Radio or Free Will, but I definitely think it works in, you know, in the sense that it, like, it's like a, like I said, it's like a lead in for me to the sort of grand conclusion that's coming.
Yeah, it's kind of like on they have a song called Tears that's on 2112 that's a ballad. Mm-hmm. Okay. Different Strings has a little bit more energy than Tears does, but it's really pretty. Mm-hmm. I really like Different Strings. I heard that for the first time when I was younger, and I think I had a girlfriend at the time who was into really you know, sentimental music, and mm-hmm. being somebody who didn't listen to music that was very sentimental, like that kind of Rush doesn't do sentimental that much. And that mm-hmm. one kind of did. I always like the chord progression and the melody. Although I will say mm-hmm. the guitar solo at the end is a little bizarre. It's cool, but yeah. it's like like sometimes I listen to it, I'm like, that's kind of, I wonder what made him go for that.
Right.
You know, it doesn't go on for very long. It kind of mm-hmm. just like takes it out. But when you listen yeah. to it, you're like, what? Really? You know, it's yeah. a little odd.
You're like, was that the one that he meant to record? Yeah. Get thrown on by accident or something. But
right.
But yeah, and then, I mean, you know, and then, you know, obviously then you move into Natural Science, which, see, Natural Science is you know, unlike Jacob's Ladder, like, is very exciting and very interesting all the way through.
Yeah.
It's interesting to me because, you know, there's a lot of music, you know, parts in that song that are repeated and repeated quite often, but there's, I don't know, there's something about the way they add little nuance to the track as it moves, you know, through the, I think it's like 9 minutes, I think,
mm-hmm.
That where it doesn't, where even though there is repetition, there's just enough added, as it moves along for it to sort of, like, you know, gain steam.
Right.
So in that sense, it, to me, it's like a sort of a completely different track, like structurally than something like Jacob's Ladder. So
yeah, you're right. I you know, I never thought of it that way, but Jacob's Ladder is a little bit, I mean, they do arrange it well, but it's a little mm-hmm. bit more stagnant than mm-hmm. Natural Science definitely has. It kind of, I think Natural Science, because it's got those three mini parts, it's mm-hmm. it broadens a little bit more than Jacob's mm-hmm. Ladder does. I that's always been one of my favorite songs, is that riff is mm-hmm. is just so yeah. It's just so big. It's just, and
right.
just so driving and mm-hmm. angular. And the fact that, you know, when I think about it, if I were to, like, sometimes I'm like, if I were to bring this idea of a song to somebody, they'd be like, really? This is what we're going to sing? Like, going right. back to the whole lyric thing, the fact that they're able to pull that off in a way that, you know, comes across in a way that you can connect with and doesn't seem so strange is kind of one of the things about Rush that is so amazing. And the fact that he's, you know, can play and sing. I remember I've seen them play it a couple of times, and it's not an easy thing to sing and play simultaneously. Remember those words. And but lyrically, it also, you know, it bookends the album in the way that Spirit of Radio does. The melodies are fantastic. I've kind of learned that the last few years. You know, you can have some lyrically, you know, you look at like something like Peter Gabriel. Like Peter Gabriel's mm-hmm. lyrics are really bizarre sometimes, but his melodies are so good. And Rush's melodies mm-hmm. are so good. And I think that's why their music stands the test of time and connects with so many people, because even like you said, even when they get really, really involved, there is always something that keeps the audience engaged with them and brings them in and doesn't just leave them in the dust.
Yeah, they're one of the, not to say that there's not other examples of bands that can sort of bring heavy elements, but at the same time there's always a hopefulness to, you know, the lyrics and to Geddy Lee's vocals. So there's always that balance sort of between darkness and light. And I think they're one of the few bands that really can pull off that balance as well as they do. And it's astounding to me that they've done it for as long as they have.
Yeah.
I mean, it's incredible. Like three people, I mean, talk about just three incredible musicians. I mean, the fact that they've had this sort of longevity.
Right.
It's just amazing to me. So
it's a, you know, like it go. Sorry to go back to that movie again, but at the end of the movie, I think it's Les Claypool says something about how when you see the three of them together, there's something that's like just so comforting about it, because like you said, here's three guys that have been together for 40 plus years. They still get along. They've been through so much. They love each other. They make music, and it's kind of like that. It's a thing that like when you see them together, when you hear their music, especially if you're a big fan of them, like you have that kind of nostalgic feel, and you're like, oh, it makes you feel good. Like, you know, like these three guys have endured this much and still get along, you know, and still do what they do, even though they're probably retiring now, but for a very long time.
when you think about just how many bands can last that long, having the same members, you know, staying together, you know, just unfortunately, you know, everybody being healthy, being alive, you know, like it really is incredible. So yeah, so there is a sort of like you said, there is a comforting, you know, aspect.
Yeah.
To when you see them together. Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. So.
And that, you know, for me, that's a connection, you know, in now we've, you know, we had a member change recently, but for the most part, you know, like I've been playing with, you know, the Mile Marker Zero guys, we've been together for a long time. And that relationship between me and the other guys, it means a lot to me. It means more to me, I think, than, you know, what I can play or what I'm allowed to do musically. You know, I mean, I'm allowed to do whatever I want, but what I'm saying is, what I mean is that I'd rather, you know, do less in MMZ than go out and have to play, you know, I mean, I'm lucky I get to do the music that I love in this band, but you know what I mean? Like I could be like, oh, I want to go play the hardest thing or go, you know, be the greatest known keyboard player or whatever. But the relationship that we have means more to me, which is why I think it glues us together.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. That's one of the great things you can tell when there's not such a dominant, you know, ego or just dominant, like, you know, you read about so many bands where, you know, they just don't last because there's, you know, like one member who's incredibly stubborn musically, or, you know, just like, you know, has to make all the decisions. So when you see these groups that just, they work so well together, that really is it's an amazing thing, and it's, you know, something I think, you know, that to be cherished. So if you had to, you know, give the album a rating, what would you give it?
Well, now you got me thinking more. when you mentioned the other things about the songs, I would probably say.
Sorry, no, I'm putting you on the spot.
No, it's okay. Like I as much as I love the album, I don't know if I can give it a 10 out of 10. I'd probably give it a 9 out of 10. You know, is that what you go off of? Is that how you?
Yeah, I mean, you like I said, you could do it. You could do it out of 10. You could do it any way you want.
I mean, it's definitely an A+ album for me. It's one of their, you know, I go back, like I said, I go back and forth between that and Hemispheres. It's definitely one of their best, where you can listen to it straight through and it doesn't, you know, even like you said, even if you're not as into some of the other ones, it does go right together, which is not always the case with some of their albums, especially like Into the 80s. But yeah, it's definitely an A+, 9 out of 10 for me, and one of my favorite, if not my favorite, album of theirs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, I gave it an 8.5 out of 10, because like I said, the only like issue I really had with the album at all, and it's not even really like a really big issue for me, is just the, you know, just the first half of Jacob's Ladder there, where it feels like you know, it feels like it slows down a little too much for me, but. But that's the thing. Sometimes, you know, I can have an issue like that with a particular song on the album, but then, you know, the piece as a whole, you know, is so good and so effective that in the end, you know, like I said, it doesn't really detract from the album for me. Like it's not like I would put on Permanent Waves and then get to Jacob's Ladder and go, oh God, and go, you know, skip to the next track. Like I wouldn't do that. You know, I think it's a good enough track, especially like I said, I love the second half. So I mean, for me. Yeah, I gave it an 8.5 out of 10. Definitely one of my favorite Rush albums. And it's interesting too, when you mentioned before about how, you know, it really doesn't bother you too much if you don't have to listen to Tom Sawyer.
I mean, like, I still love that song.
Right,
I've heard it so many times.
I get what you're saying. It's like it's one of those songs that I forget what I was watching the other day, but I was watching a document. Oh, I was watching a documentary about Joy Division, and they were talking about how the song "Love Will Tear Us Apart" is—it's one of those tracks, and I think Tom Sawyer is sort of, you know, you could say it's the same kind of thing where you know, they're so well known and they've been played so much that they become, they like transcend, you know, the band, you know, the whatever album it's on, the genre itself. It's, you know, something like Smells Like Teen Spirit, mm-hmm. or Stairway to Heaven, you know, stuff like that. Like it's these songs that become disconnected from the piece that they were, you know, a part of in the beginning. And that's always kind of disappointing to me because, you know, I obviously heard, you know, Tom Sawyer really on its own, you know, many times before I actually listened to Moving Pictures. So that's always kind of disappointing because I'm a person who loves to be able to hear an album fresh, you know, all the way through.
Sure. And I think especially for us as musicians, like, you know, it's like, oh, it's great, you know, and like when we covered Tom Sawyer not that long ago, but we had to pick it because that's the song that, you know, most people would know. You know, you have to take you have to take those things into account. And when I listened to it again, I kind of like how I did with Spirit of Radio. I noticed nuances and things that I had overlooked from hearing it so much. And it really is a great, great song. But you know that you hate to see it, you know, classic rock with the same five songs over and over again. You know,
exactly.
You know in your car what else they have.
Right. It's like anytime somebody puts a classic rock station on, whether, you know, I'm at work, whether I happen to be in somebody's car, and if Thin Lizzy comes on, it's like, if it's Thin Lizzy, it's The Boys Are Back in Town, or occasionally it's Jailbreak.
Jailbreak, yeah.
Like, they don't, it's like they know nothing else, like, they never heard another, another Thin Lizzy song from their, like, 18 albums, you know?
Sure, sure, yeah.
Yeah, it's ridiculous, so, but I guess that's, you know, much like Rush talks about, right, in Spirit of Radio, that's the industry.
Yep.
Sort of reaching in, you know, and sort of, you know, they have to have their way, which is unfortunate, but mm-hmm. I'm glad we do have bands like Rush who aren't afraid to do what they want, so.
Right.
So, all right, well, I'd like to thank you for taking the time to do this today, and,
Absolutely, thanks for having me.
Yeah, no problem at all. So to all the listeners, you guys make sure you go out and you check out Mile Marker Zero. Mark, it's been great. And you have yourself a good day, man.
Thanks, Brian. You too, man.
That concludes episode 2 of Radio Live Transmission. That episode was entitled Echoes of Permanence. And I hope you'll join me later this month for episode 3, on which I'll be bringing you reviews of new albums from Paul Bearer, Raekwon, and the Jesus and Mary Chain. Also in the main event segment of episode 3, myself and a couple of special guests will be talking about the new Depeche Mode album Spirit, as well as the classic Depeche Mode album Violator. Thank you again for listening, everybody. Have a good night.